Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as a guest the writer Ben Fountain, whose new novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, has just been published by Echo. And it's received extraordinary reviews, not only extraordinary reviews from extraordinary critics like Jeff Dyer. Probably it's one of our significant novels of the current war. But it's about wartime now, the kind of people who go off to fight, what we do to them, what we do for them, who they are, what we have done to this underclass, really. I would say it's a political novel. I would say that while it's not rabidly one-sided, it's definitely an anti-war novel, and worse, an anti-machinery publicity of war novel. Yes, how did it start?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. It started, it came out of the sense I was having around 2003, 2004, that the country was being hijacked. Hijacked financially, militarily, politically, and also in terms of the media, the mainstream message that was saturating the culture. This all came to a head right after the 2004 elections. I came to the realization that I didn't understand my country, this place where I was born and had spent my whole life. And so I walked around in a state of a pretty profound depression and confusion. And then that following Thanksgiving 2004, we had the Dallas Cowboys game on as background. We had a bunch of people over at the house. And the halftime show came on, and I think I'd had a couple of martinis. And so I was in that state where you're, you know, receptive to visions and revelations. And I just started watching the halftime show, and it's pretty much the way I write it in the book, this surreal mashup of militarism and pop culture. Lots of soldiers, lots of hip-hop dancing. Destiny's Child was the headliner. But in the middle of all this, there was a small group of American soldiers amid the hundreds of others. But these guys were in desert camos, and they were tan and lean. And I thought, they just got back. They've been over there. And the second thing I noticed in that brief instant when the camera was on them was that they were stumbling around laughing. And I thought, they're drunk. They're in the middle of this huge spectacle. Of course they'd be drunk. How else would you keep from going crazy? And the impulse for the story hit me then. What would it do to your head to have been over facing that ultimate reality, you know, of combat, and then to come back home and be dropped into this very artificial, surreal situation? And I thought, well, someday I'd like to take a run at a story like that.
Fox News, who's shot this group of men, has misidentified them. They've been identified as Bravo Squad, and so they come to be known for a military victory. Where is it?
Well, it's a fictional place, the Al-Ansakar Canal.
And they've been victorious. They've been brought to America for a hero's tour. They get a ceremonial tour, but nothing more. And they're being sent back. They're constantly calculating the odds of their own deaths during this book. And they're being sent back, having been shown what an American hero's welcome is like. And the words for it are, among other things, numbing, soul-violating, frightening. They're always afraid of being made to seem dumb, made to be embarrassed, made to do things that they would never themselves do, made to kiss people that they would never kiss or be touched by people they don't want to touch them. It's a real sense of violation and the unreality of the American media.
Yeah. At one point, one of the soldiers, the Holiday, makes the point that we're just product. We're just product. We're shuttled around from place to place. Basically, what the soldiers are, they are advertising for the business of war. And this is how the war is sold. You know, the tagline is support the troops, support the troops. And people are constantly coming up saying, we support you. We're grateful. We appreciate so much. We love you. And, you know, one of the things that I try to get across in the book is that as they're saying these things, they really mean it. They do love the soldiers. They do support the troops. But what does it mean in the end? I mean, is there a connection between those words and reality? Or are these just sounds floating free in the air and with no real connection to the situation?
I'm talking to Ben Fountain, the author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. So after the tour of this country, with the constant congratulations and the people saying, well, after what they call 9/11, they're proud to be getting a bite of ass of their own back, some sense of retaliation. And this is a group of men who know themselves. They know that they're a killing machine. They know that they're on hold, that while they're being expected to be cordial to all these celebrating, welcoming committees, that this isn't what they do. This wasn't, to the extent that they've had training in anything at all in life, it's training as killers. They haven't been educated. They can barely, most of them, speak English. Mm-hmm. That's part of it, that when they speak, they're ashamed about their grammar. Or sometimes worse, they don't know to be ashamed about their grammar. Mm-hmm. They just speak the way they were spoken to.
Right. I mean, throughout the book, Billy is, I think Billy is struggling for something genuine, something authentic, and cannot accept the congratulations of his fellow citizens, knowing that they actually have no idea what they're talking about. And at certain points, he says he views them as children, basically. I mean, he feels this weird tenderness for them and pity and also contempt. I mean, at one point, he says, you know, nobody has called us baby killer, but I wish they would. There would be, you know, in that insult, at least some understanding of what has gone on because babies have been killed. At another point, he says, Americans are children who have to go somewhere else to grow up and sometimes die. So there's this fundamental disconnect between the reality he's encountering over here and that ultimate reality over in Iraq. And ultimately, it's a question of his own survival. And, you know, in large terms, any country that loses its grasp of reality isn't long for this world. And certainly the young men it puts out on the front lines to fight its wars, if there's not a real recognition of the circumstances and situations that the country is putting these young men and women into, they're doomed.
The lovely thing about this novel is that while its attitudes are not obscured, its characters are Americans. They speak like Americans. They don't, by and large, vent anti-war propaganda.
Right.
They have not been brainwashed. They say what they say. They're striving for accuracy. And if anything, Billy is a bit of a naive. He's a virgin. He's 19 years old. He's in the army. It's not that he doesn't want to have sex. He can't wait, but he doesn't want it to happen too quickly. When he thinks about Beyoncé, well, mm-hmm. You say it. It's a great laugh line.
Well, Billy is 19 years old, and we all know what 19-year-old, you know, heterosexual, reasonably healthy American men want. But Billy wants more. He wants not just a woman. He wants a girlfriend. He wants the body connection, but he also wants the soul connection. And the soldiers are very aware that at some point they're going to be in proximity with Destiny's Child and Beyoncé. And someone tells Billy, you know, they shouldn't just introduce you to Destiny's Child. They should let you get with them. And Billy starts thinking, would I? You know, would I actually sleep with her if I had the chance? How about this? What I'd really like to do is for Beyoncé and me to go off on a 3-week vacation, and we can play board games, and we can eat ice cream cones, and we can just hang out in this nice way and maybe fall in love, but also in our spare time we can have a lot of sex as well. So, and you know, that's a fantasy, but as Sigrid Sassoon said, soldiers are dreamers.
He was born around 80 miles from the Dallas Stadium, but he's never been there in his life.
Right.
When he gets there, this is, you know, a big event. He thinks it should be a religious event, but the stadium itself is so ugly that it doesn't meet his need for a spiritual experience.
Right. I mean, Billy, throughout the book, right, Billy is poorly educated. And he has come to realize that. And partly through the help of his mentor in the platoon, Sergeant, well, he goes by the nickname of Shroom, but his name is Sergeant Bream. And he was killed in the engagement in Iraq. But Billy's not stupid. On the contrary, he's acutely sensitive to all these things that are going on around him. And he's started to read books, and he's started to think about the big questions. They've been forced upon him. And the way Shroom puts it, when people asked him, why do you read so much? He says, I'm trying to form my personality. I'm trying to create a self.
Well, this is a book, like certain American books, it's trying to forge a sense of the American identity now. I would say that, among other things, it's like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Shroom is a character like Chief Broom. He's the, you know, the deeper spirit of the book.
Right.
And, you know, we've got that incredible debut novel, Not Enough People Read It, by Robert Stone, called A Hall of Mirrors, mm-hmm. which is really about the con game of trying to sell America, trying to stuff America down America's throat. And, you know, there are books by Norman Mailer come to mind as well. In the course of the book, because I think people should hear the sound of this book as soon as possible, there's a Hollywood producer. Well, we all know him. What's his name?
Albert.
Albert Ratner, I
Correct.
Think. And he's the kind of producer who produced Oscar-winning hits, but around 10 years ago. So, you know, anyone who lives in Los Angeles knows this man is trying to get back into the game. He's found his subject matter, the squadron, and he's trying to convince them that they're going to make a lot of money on their deal. And any first-time screenwriter knows how that works, mm-hmm. too. You make promises, and eventually you teach the person they have to take what they're going to get.
Right.
Let's hear a little bit about the vision of reality that a movie can bring to these men.
All right. Well, this is Billy thinking about the whole prospect of getting a feature film made about the Bravos experience. And it's toward the end of the game, and so things are starting to fall apart. But anyway, here's Billy. Why make a movie anyway? It seems pointless to go to all that trouble when the original is floating out there for all to see, easily available online by searching Alan Sachar Canal, Bravo Snuff Movie, America's Throbbing Justice, or any one of a couple of dozen of similar phrases that summon forth the Fox News footage. 3 minutes and 43 seconds of high-intensity warfare is seen through a stumbling "you are there" point of view, the battle sounds backgrounded by a slur of heavy breathing and the bleeped expletives of the daring camera crew. It's so real it looks fake, too showy, too hyped up and cinematic, a B-movie's defiant or defensive flirtation with the referential limits of kitsch. Would a more polished product serve better, one wonders? Throw in some story arc, a good dose of character development, artful lighting, and multiple camera angles, plus a soundtrack to tee up the emotive cues. Nothing looks so real as a fake, apparently, though ever since seeing the footage for himself, Billy has puzzled over the fact that it doesn't look like any battle he was ever in. Therefore, you have the real that looks fake twice over, the real that looks so real it looks fake, and the real that looks nothing like the real and thus fake. So maybe you do need all of Hollywood's craft and guile to bring it back to the real. Then again, everybody always says how much like a movie the Fox footage is. Like Rambo, they say. First Blood. Like Independence Day. Or, as one of their new neighbors in Row 6 says, a perky, chatty 20-something blonde who's shown up with her husband and another young couple, "It was just like 9/11 all over again. I sat down and cut on the news and got the weirdest feeling I was watching a movie on cable." "You guys rock," says her husband, a handsome, strapping fellow in a Patagonia parka and heirloom-quality cowboy boots. It felt darn good to see us finally getting some payback. The other young husband and wife echo the sentiment. They aren't much older than Billy, these two young couples who've migrated down from the upper deck for a sampling of the money seats at garbage time. They remind Billy of certain kids he went to high school with, the sons and daughters of the small-town country club elite who were firmly embedded in the college track. And here they are in their mid-20s, duly credentialed and married, starting out their grown-up lives on schedule. The young couples are eager to meet the Texas Bravo, but for a moment they don't know what to make of him in the flesh. "You're just a kid," one of the wives cries, breaking the ice. Then they're introducing themselves and thanking him for his service, the two young wives breathy and fond, the husband's racking his arm with welcome to the frat handshakes. "Awesome," they say, "outstanding, an honor to meet you," and so forth, their words sloshing around Billy's brain like soft ice cubes. Courage, honor, sacrifice, bravery, proud, and kicking ass.
That was Ben Fountain reading a section toward the end of Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Ben Fountain about Billy Lynn's long halftime walk in which a squad of soldiers has been made famous by Fox News. They're on a victory tour to create support for the Iraq War. They participate in Beyoncé's halftime show at a Dallas Cowboys Thanksgiving football game, but they are just hours from being redeployed back to the brutal war zone that haunts the novel's hero. Now, the book is pretty careful to take us for its first third on a ride from the eyes of Billy. And Billy is learning on this trip. In other words, this isn't an I Hate America novel. This is a novel of people coming to consciousness about something that they can't, that they don't know, that they haven't known before. I think a lot of writers have been nervous about writing this novel, this exact novel, because of the gulf between a soldier and a reader of novels.
Or a writer of novels.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this brings up a technical problem in this book. And it's one I wrestled with, and I don't know if I successfully resolved it. But, I mean, I wanted my character to be Billy Lynn, this 19-year-old soldier with a poor high school education from a small town in Texas. He's not what you would call a intellectual or sophisticated person, but he's very aware of the world around him, and he's very sensitive to shades and gradations of human experience across the board. And so, you know, my job was, well, I had two choices. I could either do it strictly through his stream of consciousness, his point of view, his diction, or I could, and this would give me, you know, the latter option would give me wider field, you know, latitude of movement. I could take this approach. If you sat Billy down at any one particular moment in the course of this day and walked through with him, what are you feeling? What are you thinking? And he had time to articulate and think about exactly what he was experiencing, those words on the page are what he would say. I thought, well, I'll take that approach. He's actually thinking and feeling all of these things, these, you know, at times pretty complex experiences, and he's registering all these with varying degrees of consciousness and articulation, internal articulation. So I thought, well, I want to go that route because I want as much freedom of movement as I can get in this book.
Well, also, a good deal of the time, he's imagining himself talking to his mentor, Shroom, for whom Billy is pretty much standing on tippy toes because, you know, Shroom has given him all these books and told him about religious experiences and things in the world wider than Billy's framework. So Billy's observation of this America is trying to be something that he thinks Shroom would be interested in hearing.
Right.
You know, that he's growing in Shroom's eyes. The dead Shroom, the Shroom that he pulled out of battle, whose corpse he held.
Right. Shroom may be the first true teacher he's ever had. And he didn't get very much time with Shroom, but maybe he got enough. He got enough to know, to have a sense of what he doesn't know. And so he is developing an inquiring mind. He's asking questions and really paying attention to what's in front of him.
What's thrilling in this book is it's another book of the American, you know, the American Vulgate, the American colloquial. It's all full of Texas and ghetto black and lots of hip-hop, lots of the sounds that America is making right now that have a powerful effect, a spellbinding effect on what we think and who we are.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the book came to me, first of all, I mean, after the, you know, raw impulse for the story, seeing those soldiers at halftime, the next thing was the sound of it. And that's often the way things work for me. I mean, the story presents itself not just as an idea, but it has a sound. And it took me a lot of years to recognize what was going on in my own head and to pay attention to it. So part of my job is to, you know, tune into that signal, that what seems to be the appropriate sound for the book or the story, and find the words to get it on the page that way. And with Billy, the appropriate sound seemed to me to be this headlong, no-holds-barred mashup of, you know, fairly high diction, an idiom that is capable of hopefully a certain amount of complexity mixed up with, you know, the language of the street, you know, maybe the crudest mashup of pop culture and low culture and middlebrow culture, because that's what America is today. It's this huge, you know, I mean, to go back to the Temptation song, ball of confusion, and it's making all kinds of sounds. And I just felt like the sound appropriate to this book was hopefully a rich stew of sounds and idioms.
Well, I want to take that even a step further. I'm facing Ben Fountain, author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, published by Echo. He goes to undergraduate school. He goes to law school. He meets his wife there. Together, lawyers, they go to live in Dallas. He wants to be a writer, but he hasn't been a writer. Being a writer is a hard thing to be. It's like walking away from the army, especially if you've been a lawyer. You know, good salary, stable point of view, lots of things you would question, but nothing that you question emotionally, all from within the dictates of the law. He writes a book of short stories, very good book, called Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, 8 stories. Seem to be exposing him. He travels to Haiti. He imagines traveling to Sierra Leone. He travels to the world's trouble spots and realizes somehow in there that the most troubled spot of all might just be the American soul. And that gives him a subject. Tell me, am I near right?
I've been improvising the whole way, just going by feel and stumbling along and hoping that I'm halfway getting it right. And there's really been no plan or premeditation in all this. Maybe at certain points in retrospect, I can say, oh, that looks like I was sort of thinking about what I was doing. But a lot of it is by accident and just going by feel.
Well, that's what writing is, huh?
For me, it is. It's going on faith. I mean, the only way you learn what the story is to write it. But how do you write it when you don't know what the story is? And so you do it line by line.
I've been talking with Ben Fountain, author most recently of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, published by Echo. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Rathine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.